911,
what's your emergency?
There's somebody got shot at Spider Filsonoco.
Okay, what's the address there, sir?
I don't know, 7209, I think.
Okay,
somebody
got shot? The guy is dead.
Wait a minute, man. He's laying on the car.
We got just shot out here. I'm on the corner of Chalmia
and Georgia Street.
What's going on there?
There's a dude just got shot here at the intersection.
3 weeks in October 2002, a time seared into our memories.
But stepping over the line, shooting a kid, I guess it's getting to be really, really personal now.
Absolute horror. This isn't supposed to happen in a community like this.
As two murderous snipers encircled the Washington, D.C. area, a time when we all realized that our life or death in those 22 days was just a matter of chance.
Welcome back to our Fox 5 True Crime Podcast, 3 weeks of hell, the D.C. snipers. This is episode 5. Just want to remind you, episode 4, Melanie, was this great interview that you had with one of the snipers' ex-wife, Mildred Muhammad, who still lives in our area and was very compelling. It was a great episode.
Thank you very much. And that was part one. Of course, more to come from Mildred. But as we recalled, in that first week of October 2002, now the snipers had shot 7 innocent people, each one of them dropped by a single shot. 6 killed, 1 survived. And that weekend, October, as the air began to chill, families really kind of pulled their families close, especially as news from the sniper task force provided us no comfort.
3 of the killings have been linked to the same weapon, 223 rounds. The ability of the suspect to strike again remained extremely high.
Monday, October 7th, the nightmare began again with the shooting of a 13-year-old boy in Prince George's County.
Prince George's County Emergency Center.
Can I help you?
Oh, my gosh. I think I'm going to be able to drive my nephew to the hospital, but
what's the matter with him?
He just got shot.
We have breaking news right now. If you've been with us, then you know hundreds of police are looking for a sharpshooter who has struck again. His latest victim, a 13-year-old boy, is in critical condition, fighting for his life. And here is where it all started. Kids at Benjamin Tasker Middle School in Bowie, Maryland, were ushered inside this morning after that boy was shot just moments after he had been dropped off.
I was one of the reporters on the scene that day.
The shot fired at 8:09 this morning. There was utter chaos here because you had parents coming to the school wanting to get their kids out.
I was worried because this never happened like this before at my school. And I was worried because I ain't wanted to die like that.
It was a terrifying day during an awful time. The young person shot was Iron Brown, the youngest of the sniper's victims, just 13 years old. He was shot and wounded as he was dropped off at his middle school in Prince George's County. I've wanted to speak to Iron ever since that terrible day. We recently got the chance to visit remotely. Iron now lives outside Atlanta. I first asked how he's doing.
Thank you, Bob. I'm doing very well. Most importantly, I'm alive, I'm vibrant, I'm healthy, just living my best life, enjoying this Southern hospitality, and it's most definitely a beautiful thing.
That morning, 20 years ago, Iron's aunt, Tanya Brown, had taken him to school, Benjamin Tasker Middle in Bowie, Maryland. Iron had just gotten out of her car when he was shot in the stomach.
Just taking you down memory lane, my aunt was dropping me off at school and I was returning from actually being suspended from the school bus from eating a Twizzler, ironically. And as superstitious as it is, I haven't eaten a Twizzler ever since. But it was a early morning. She would drop me off right before she would report to work. And essentially, as soon as I got out of her car, it happened that fast. And of course, you just heard a loud bang as if a grenade went off. And immediately, I knew I was shot. Of course, with me never being shot before, I guess intuition and just instincts just kicked in. And one thing led to another. And next thing you know, I was just fighting and grasping for air. And that day forever changed me.
Did you hear the shot?
Everybody heard it who was in the immediate area. It was literally like a grenade went off and it was just an echo and it was just a loud bang. And as far as I'm concerned, they were already positioned there. before I had arrived. And as soon as I got out of the car, she didn't even have an opportunity to pull out of the driveway. And I was shot immediately. And I like to believe that maybe Malvo was aiming for my heart, because that's essentially where I was pierced by the hollow tip bullet. And I have a pretty cool scar I can show you as well.
We'll take him up on that offer later. Immediately after he was shot, Iron's aunt, a nurse, grabbed him, put him in her car, and drove to the nearby Bowie Health Center emergency room.
I gotta go past! Let me go past!
Tanya Brown called 911 from her cell phone.
Are you okay, Iron? Okay.
Okay, he's still breathing, right?
Yes, he's still breathing, but he looks pale.
And he has personal.
Hold it, Iron.
Well, thankfully, my aunt, she works for Children's Hospital, where I was eventually admitted. And everything just worked out in my favor. She did not wait for any ambulance. Instead, she drove me to the nearest clinic, which was literally right around the corner and up the street. And thankfully, they actually had my blood type there, which was essential in saving my life. I truly believe so.
I know there are people who say, had you waited for an ambulance, had your aunt not thought that quickly and gotten you to the facility, you very well could have died.
Yes, sir. I truly believe that. Even though we give all the glory to the Most High, you know, my aunt's actions were pivotal. And again, I was gasping for air. I was turning pale. I was losing so much blood. I had to roll the window down to help me breathe. It was an intense moment. I truly thought I was going to die. I can remember praying and just essentially just preparing to pass away. I was telling my aunt how much I loved her. And if I recall just hearing the 911 call play back, it was pretty emotional.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Okay, I know. Getting ready to turn in right now.
And you have said you didn't see who shot him, he doesn't know.
I didn't see anybody.
And he didn't see anybody.
No.
Okay, go ahead and go in the ER. We're gonna send an officer out, okay?
Okay.
And take me through those first days. What do you remember about them, you know, surviving and starting on your recovery?
So I was maybe in the hospital for a little over a month, and I was in an induced coma for a little over a week. And I remember just opening my eyes and my mother being the first person I saw, and it was very emotional. And, my whole family rushed in and support me. And, you know, I definitely like to credit my family for helping me through the process, just keeping me as normal as possible, just, you know, living life. Day to day, you know, not giving into the situation, because there was a certain time where Malvo and Muhammad, they were not caught yet. So it was some rough nights for sure.
They were out to kill people. I mean, the thought that there's another human being out there who was roughly your age, who had every intention of actually killing you for whatever possible reason. What? Tell me about that.
It was intense. I can recall, even as young as I was, I you know, just like everybody else in the area, you were, you know, glued to the TV. You were conscious that, you know, these guys were loose, pumping gas, going in zigzags. And I can even recall maybe a week prior to me being shot, we were still going outside. As far as like for physical education, you know, PE class. And I remember saying to the staff, why are we going outside with the snipers still being loose and they're not caught yet? And they truly did have the entire DMV area in fear.
For Iron, the shooting was physically devastating.
So Bob, I can recall the doctors who did their procedure on me, did the immediate surgery. They explained that it looked like a bomb had went off inside of me. I was shot by a Bushmaster sniper rifle, and the caliber bullet was a 223 caliber. It was maybe this big, long, this wide, and it was a hollow tip. So essentially when it pierced me, it exploded. And I have a pretty cool scar I can show you. And they definitely did a lot of damage, removed my stomach, my spleen, pancreas, everything was damaged. But I think what worked in my favor was that I was still a child. So essentially, you know, my body was still growing and it adjusted better than if I were an adult.
Are there some lasting impacts of that, like things you can't do, things you maybe can't ingest or whatever?
Yeah, so essentially I still have bullet fragments inside of me. And you know, over time they move and they shift and they'll create issues going forward. So I've always had to deal with the fact that I'll never be 100%. But I mean, I'm alive, so I, you know, you won't find me complaining about anything. I do have nerve damage. I've never been clinically diagnosed, but I do suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, some anxiety issues, understandably so. And again, every time I look in the mirror and lift my shirt up, it's just a daily reminder of what I've been through.
Iron showed us the scars that are still clearly visible. You can see them if you're watching this podcast.
This is where the bullet actually pierced me. This was all immediate surgery. These here looks like other bullet wounds, but they was just like maybe bags of blood and things of that nature. I had a lot of tubes in me. I couldn't eat or drink. They had to feed me through my veins, essentially, because if I would have eaten or drinking anything, I could have choked on myself. And yeah, this is my pretty cool scar.
While Iron was in the hospital recovering from those wounds, the snipers were still on the loose.
When I actually woke up from a coma, they were not arrested yet. So I did suffer from nightmares and just being nervous, thinking that they were going to come to my hospital room and finish the job because they weren't identified yet. So you can imagine, it was only but so much people could say to me to keep me calm. So they actually had to register me under a different name, and I was not under my legal name during my stay in the hospital. I had a completely different, it was like I was in protective custody, because essentially everyone knew where I was being treated. And so by them not being identified, they could have easily, like I said, came and finished the job. But I do recall when they were captured, and once again, my mother was the one who broke the news to me, because we were following along with the TV coverage, and it was essentially everywhere. So that was a great day for sure.
And soon, Iron went back to school.
It was a huge adjustment just dealing with all of that attention and me just naturally being reserved. It was overwhelming. I was even completing homework packets while I was in the hospital. Again, that's a testament to my family and also, you know, to myself, just wanting to be as normal as possible and just to resume my life, because essentially my life was interrupted. And I was in the hospital for, like I said, a little over 1 month. And as soon as I was discharged, I maybe returned back to school maybe a week or two later.
Iron now lives with his mother in Georgia. He's a father of a 3-year-old boy. Iron's been working at Home Depot and writing a memoir. And yes, says he considers himself lucky to be alive.
It's a pretty big deal for me to be a part of history, you know, whether I like it or not, or how traumatizing it's been. And it's been a long time coming for sure.
So Bob, I don't know why it just kind of stuck in my head, his comments about that he was eating a Twizzler and that he won't eat Twizzlers anymore. That's one of those things, you know, traumatic things happen to you or people, and there's one part about it always that'll stick in your head.
Well, and that's because only reason really that his aunt took him to school that day was because he was coming off a suspension for eating the Twizzler on the school bus. He also thinks that, like, he said his bus was the first one to arrive at school most mornings. So in his mind, he kind of thinks that even if he hadn't gotten in trouble for eating the Twizzler on the school bus and had taken the bus to school that morning, that he would have probably been one of the first ones off. He just kind of feels like he was destined to have been the one shot there, whether his aunt had dropped him off or he took the school bus and hadn't been suspended.
Well, I just love that we were able to hear from him, because as you said, people had wondered for so many years, what went through his mind, what was happening. And the 911 call from his aunt was just riveting.
And she was calm, because I think the school was initially like wondering, why is this lady taking this kid who thinks he's been shot? And we heard a gunshot, and the police were like, lady, what are you doing? He and others have credited her being a quick-thinking nurse. I'm not waiting for an ambulance. There's a health center emergency room just down the road. I'm taking him there. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the names, because so many of these people, unfortunately, were killed during the sniper spree. He survived. 13-year-old boy, Iron Brown, everybody who covered it remembers that name, and to have been able to meet him, talk to him, and share him with our listeners, our viewers here now, is I'm glad we were able to do that.
Yeah, fascinating. And I know you have more from him coming up in another episode.
Yeah, he's going to talk about coming face-to-face with one of the snipers, John Allen Muhammad, in his murder trial in a Virginia courtroom. So Iron will hear from him in a later episode talking about what that was like, eventually at one point coming face to face with one of his would-be killers.
And as we know now, that particular shooting was where one of the major clues, that first clue, was left, that tarot card.
By the snipers.
That card is now in storage at the National Law Enforcement Museum. And when you see it, it's one of those things that kind of makes you catch your breath. It's palm-sized, a little beat up, fuzzy on the edges. There is a white horse with a black skeleton knight on it, the single word death centered in the bottom margin. On the top margin, written in blue ink with kind of childish lettering, those words, call me God. On the back, for you, Mr. Police, call me God. Do not release to the press.
But it was leaked to a member of the press that very day.
Once they left the tarot card and said, call me God, all the subsequent shootings, they communicated or left something behind to let us know it's us. And, you know, it was a mind game that they're playing with us. You know, in my opinion, they felt they had control and they could manipulate us.
Mike Bouchard is a retired federal agent. He was in charge of the ATF's investigation of the sniper case.
Yeah, the toughest thing with this whole thing is there was no playbook for, this never happened before. You know, multi-jurisdiction, different types of victims, different locations, different times of the day, shooting from a distance, no witnesses. So again, it was, you know, we're kind of dealing with this on the fly and being creative, and everyone drew from their past experiences about, and we talked a lot about strategies. You know, what's the best way to go about this?
Bouchard says discovering the tarot card and the shooting of a child clearly touched a nerve.
We know that Chief Moose reacted emotionally to Iron getting shot. Did you guys, did that kind of switch it for you guys as well? Hey, they're going after kids now.
Yeah, emotionally it shook all of us up. You know, I had two children. One was in college, one was in high school at the time. So yeah, shooting at a young kid going into middle school, you know, when you do these things, you try and check your emotions as best possible. Sometimes your emotions take over, like all of us, so we were fortunate we were able to stay composed at the time.
We're going to hear more from Mike Bouchard as we discuss evidence found at that and subsequent crime scenes in our next episode.
And there were two more sniper killings that second week of the terror spree. On October 9th, at a Sunoco gas station on Sudley Road in Manassas, Dean Myers was shot and killed while pumping gas.
911, where's your emergency?
Yeah, somebody got shot. It's by the Sunoco.
Okay, what's the address there, sir?
I don't know. 7209, I think.
Okay, somebody got shot.
The guy is dead. He's laying on the car.
It was for the shooting of Dean Myers that sniper John Allen Muhammad got the death penalty. Myers was a 53-year-old civil engineer, a Vietnam veteran who lived in Maryland and commuted to his job in Prince William County. And remember we talked in episode 2 about the Sony Vaio laptop that had been stolen from the first shooting victim, Paul LaRuffa? During Muhammad's trial, it was revealed that a map showing a route to that gas station where Myers was murdered was found on the computer's hard drive. And then 2 days later, on Friday, October 11th, Kenneth Bridges was shot and killed at an Exxon gas station in Spotsylvania County. Bridges was also 53, a married father of 6 children. He was on his cell phone speaking with his wife when he was killed.
That shooting touched off a massive surge of traffic along I-95 near Fredericksburg as police narrowed the highway to one lane and inspected every vehicle, but the killers got away. It was the end of the second week of the snipers' deadly shooting spree. There was more killing, more sadness, more clues left behind. with the hunt for the killers intensifying.
So, Bob, I know you covered that Dean Meyer shooting. That is a day for you that you have very specific memories of.
It was a colder, rainy night. I remember it was just kind of a mess. And, I mean, it was another gas station. And I remember seeing, like, there was the Bob Evans. Like, it's still there. I mean, anytime we go for stories, it's one of those other places. The Sunoco is still there where Dean Meyer was killed. The Bob Evans across the street. And you realize that's where the snipers were shooting across 234 and killed this man while he was gassing up. It was definitely the end of a second week of this terror spree. And I just remember being in the pouring rain. And initially you went there not knowing for sure this was another sniper victim, even though it was a man shot dead at a gas station. You figured it was. And then we learned, I believe, before we even left that scene that night that, yeah, this is the latest victim.
Wow. So that was the second week. And this is really where this whole cat and mouse game that we learned about later between the snipers and the investigators on the task force was about to begin. And we also asked investigators, this is coming up in our next episode, about that white box truck and what went wrong there.
Right. I mean, that was from day one, the focus of the public's concern was looking out for this white box truck. And looking back, it was clear that they were not ever in a white box truck. And that probably took away opportunities for not only the public, but the police, the investigators, to track these guys down before it went into a third week.
And we're going to go into that a little bit more in episode 6 as well.
Right. Well, thank you for listening in on this one. You know, we're talking about messaging. You've heard a little bit about the tarot card, search for the box truck, a lot of evidence and fear growing in episode 6.
Great. So don't forget to join us on all of your podcast platforms. You can also watch our video recordings, as you're watching here, on our YouTube channel on Fox 5 DC.
And you just go to your phone, you hit podcast on your Fox 5 app and on our website and stay with us.
There's more to come.